I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind the people bringing science to society. From challenges to opportunities, we uncover the impact of research on policy, community, and ultimately, you. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. Today we are here with an associate professor in the School of Health and Human Performance and the principal investigator of the Cognitive and Motor Performance Lab, Heather Niedli.
Hello.
Heather, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So, I mean, that introduction said quite a bit. So I'm in the Division of Kinesiology, but I also, my work spans the areas of psychology and neuroscience and industrial engineering. And I think outside of the lab, my main hobby that's relevant to my work is I'm a rugby coach. So I coach a local high school team as well as the Dalhousie women's rugby team.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, I didn't know that you were in the rugby field.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I've played for a number of years. I'm not playing anymore because it's too rough on the body now, but coaching's really fun.
I was flying back from Victoria just last week, and I ended up on a plane with like 20 UBC male rugby players.
Oh, wow.
Where you sit in between two of them, and there's
thankfully, like... they like sat beside each other, but like they are huge.
Yeah.
They are huge. Actually, one of them did sit beside me, and it was definitely like bumping elbows and knees because they had to take up a lot of space.
But yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely cool to see, though. And then I came to Dalhousie, and I saw them practicing on the field.
So. Oh, nice. Yeah,
fun. It was a fun... Yeah, they went from coast to coast. It must have been a very eventful game. Yeah. And I do think... to some degree, a little bit of a disadvantage with the time change for them.
Yeah.
It'd be a lot to adjust, for sure.
Yeah. So we have a fun segment. Typically, in previous podcasts, we do first date questions. So to get to know you a little bit better. But seeing that you are a principal investigator, instead, what we have done is we have asked your students to ask their parents what they think they do for research.
Oh, no.
And so they've come in with their responses, and we're going to ask you to rate them on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of accuracy.
Okay.
Okay. All so right. We'll kick this off with Brett. It's remains anonymous as to who Brett asked, but for Brett's response, we have, you study why we use the brain when we do things.
Okay, in terms of accuracy, that's not wrong.
Yeah.
You know, whoever answered this had a great, like, great strategy of being quite general. So, accuracy high, and I respect that strategy. So I'm going to give it a 6.
Okay, nice.
Solid.
Yeah.
The next one comes from Chris. I think you specialize in artificial intelligence because you have equipment that I've never seen in my life, right down to an automated lawnmower.
Oh.
And Julia and I have questions about this automated lawnmower.
Yes. Well, so that's interesting because we don't actually have an automated lawnmower in our lab. I think that's just Chris's hobby. He likes, I guess he's also taking his hobbies outside the lab, and that's manifested as an automated lawnmower. So he does study like automation potentially as applications to AI, so that's kind of accurate. But yeah, there's no lawnmowers in our lab, unfortunately.
I was very curious.
Yeah, the basement of the Dalplex doesn't have a lot of grass, so yeah. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to give that one a 4. There was hints of accuracy, but there was like a blend of personal and school life.
Yeah. All right. So the next one are two parts from Christine. So part one, we have, you tickle people's brains to help people live better lives. I'll have you rank them 1, at a time.
Okay. I'm still laughing about tickling people's brains. I'm just picturing like opening up a brain. I'm wiggling my fingers right now, which I realize nobody can see. But I guess maybe stimulate people's brains, do stuff. So yeah, I have to give that one a 4 too.
Yeah.
There's a brain in there.
So I'm curious, does Christine work with some sort of neuroimaging device?
She does. She uses a functional near infrared spectroscopy, or FNIR. So it uses light waves to measure brain activity. And what she's doing is actually really, really cool, is she's doing neurofeedback. So she's taking people's brain activity, showing it back to them, and then what they're using that visual display to try to change it. So I guess maybe that's the tickling part, but it's kind of your own feedback loop.
Tickling's like a, not a metaphor, what's it called? It's like they're using it loosely.
Yeah. Yes.
Tickling, like.
Yeah, or maybe they were there and.
They are literally meaning tickling. Yeah. I'm trying to help Christine's parents.
But not the actual brain that got tickled. Who knows?
Yeah.
So part two, we have. You have people try on a funky hat.
Yes. Yeah. The FNIR is a funky hat. It's kind of looks like if you're familiar with EEG, it looks like an EEG cap.
Okay.
So, but if you're not familiar with EEG, it's kind of a tight swim elasticy thing. It messes up your hair.
Yeah.
And it has little little kind of electrodes attached to it.
Okay.
So yeah. So I would say, again, went very general. So I appreciate that. So I'll give that a 7.
Okay. Yeah. Nice.
I think that's the highest one so far.
Yes. Yeah. I think so.
Yes. You have people trying a funky hat, got a 7.
I'm just wondering if this person's sitting there with a funky hat and we're tickling their brain, and then that's Christine's research program.
Yeah. Yeah.
The next one comes from Chelsea's parents, not sure which one. Also, shout out to Chelsea. She's the one who helped us get in touch with your lab and get all the answers.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah. They said, you use computers to look at why we do small, inconsequential tasks.
Actually, that is very accurate, because sometimes what we do in the lab does seem very inconsequential. We're having people, you know, aim at dots at the screen, like point at them, or do these simple things, and like hopefully they have real world context. But I'm gonna have to give that a 10 out of 10.
Oh, nice.
That's cutting a bit too close. So
yeah. Okay, so then the next one that we have is ranked anonymous.
Anonymous because this can apply to anyone in the lab. Mm-hmm. According to Chelsea.
To Chelsea.
And I think it could apply to any grad student.
Yes.
Okay.
To be honest.
So, complain about not knowing how to code or do stats.
Although we try to have a not complaining about that rule. But
yeah, I'm curious if this is like them complaining on not knowing, or like reading a researcher's paper and complaining that they don't know how.
Yeah. But it does happen. It's,
yeah.
It's challenging. But yes, I'm going to give it a 5 because it's true. But I want us to be like empowered to feel like we can learn stats and code.
Yeah, because we can code and do stats.
Yeah.
So the last one comes from Sierra's parents. And they said, research around the integration of artificial intelligence and human interaction to generate positive outcomes that are not about replacing the human component, but about creating environments where the combination of human and AI produces superior outcomes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think Sierra's parents should probably just come on the podcast.
Join the lab.
Yeah.
Be a part of the next publication.
Yeah, that was really fantastic. I'm going to give that a 20 out of
10.
It was very specific. Too.
Yeah,
like,
right?
It wasn't the general strategy. Like, it went full. The AI thing, again, is we don't necessarily deal fully with there's a whole other discussion about what is AI, but but in terms of like specificity, getting on like big picture goals, but also really describing what she does, that was great.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did the same segment with Dr. Sean Bow, and I can confidently say none of our parents did very well.
No.
In fact, one person got like negative.
Yeah. Oh no. Well, maybe I'm a nicer scorer.
Well, to be fair, the person who got negative said, "I don't know. Any thoughts?" And it's like, she's just bouncing the question back
to the person who knows. Hopefully knows.
That's a good strategy.
Yeah, that is true. It's like, you tell me and I'll regurgitate it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was, I'm impressed with Sierra's parents, though.
Yeah.
I asked my parents and they didn't give me a response. they're more, I'll get to it kind of people. So, So, I would like to give you a chance to give an overview of what kind of research you conduct in the lab.
Yeah, and I feel I say it's kind of my elevator pitch, so I'm going to go into my elevator pitch voice. Yeah. But so the Cognitive Motor Performance Lab kind of has three main research streams. The first is really trying to understand how our brain controls movement. So this area is known as like motor control and learning. And in a lot of cases, we focus on how we move to achieve our goals while avoiding negative outcomes. The second area is a little bit more applied psychology. So I do a lot of human technology interaction, which is what's kind of come out in a lot of these answers. And we've done some of that work in sports. So how, for instance, how people use technology in golf. But I also do a lot of research with Defense Research and Development Canada on how we can integrate technology into more defense systems and how humans use it and trust it. And then the final area is kind of broadly, how can we change the brain to make better performance? So, you know, that's kind of touching on Christine's work in neurofeedback, but we also have some great students working on things like, how can exercise change the brain in positive ways and help you have better cognitive function as you age?
That's very cool. I don't think I knew a lot of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting scenario where we do a lot of very, they're obviously related in some ways, but they're kind of very different areas.
Yeah. I feel like as a result, you must just get such a diverse range of students come your way. And I think like the really cool thing of having so many different research areas within one lab is that you get, I guess, more creative thought that crosses between the students and stuff. And you see like the connections between the research questions, even though the topics might be different.
Yeah. And I want that to happen more, but it kind of slowly percolates up. But I think it's this challenge to say, okay, how can I take something from this area and move it over? And I guess because I created this thing, and it makes it sound like I had a lot of control, but it was just like, I just do whatever I'm interested in and can't say no. And then you end up with too many projects on the go. But so I start to see the links, but they're not always obvious and there. So it's definitely sometimes a challenge because, you know, like I know your lab works really, really well together as a team. And it's trying to produce that team environment when one person is studying underwater mines and another person is tickling the brain. So
someone's just putting on funny hats.
Yeah. I definitely think that there is a lot of potential for cohesiveness across the topics, even though they seem vastly different. I mean, at the end of the day, they're all revolving around, well, broadly neuroscience,
I think it's interesting in your lab, I actually did, I think it was Sierra's study, the underwater mine detection, which was, that was a whole different experience. I thought it was really interesting because you have people in your lab doing more like what you would say is basic science and like fundamental, and then you have really applied and working with like the Navy and stuff. So I think that's interesting, even if you are a more fundamental student in the lab, to see how research connects and can be applied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually probably the best connection that there's a real benefit of. We're both doing very, very fundamental research. Like, something pops up on the screen and you point at it and you get 100 points. Like, that's not like, it's sometimes hard to see how that applies, but then building it up to stuff that is a little bit more real-world context and kind of getting that kind of full vein running through the lab.
I realized doing that study, I never want to detect mines or be responsible for detecting a mine.
I have yet to do it, but I am in the process of being recruited.
So we won't spoil it then.
Yeah. We will. We'll see. We'll wait and have to do a follow-up on that one. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think, like, all the research that you're doing is still, like, just so interesting. And it's cool to see something from, like, health and human performance translate into, like, defense research. It's, like, not a connection I would have, like, made in my mind right off the bat. So it's very cool.
Yeah, and, you know, you're kind of really tapping into human performance. And we tend to think, well, health and human performance or kinesiology, it's going to be sports or clinical, but there's so many other performance setting where we want people to perform well. So we can take a lot what we learn from, in particular, you know, I'm fond of sports, like a sports context, and thinking how can we apply that somewhere else.
Heather, can you briefly tell us a little recap about your research journey? So, like, where and what you did for bachelor's, master's, PhD, postdoc, etc.
All right. So, like, once upon a time, my research journey started actually in second year undergrad. I was taking motor controlled learning, which is a required kin course, taught by Dr. David Westwood, who's another faculty member. And he's like, hey, you're doing pretty well on the test. Why don't you apply for the scholarship to, like, work in the lab for the summer? And at the time, I was working, I think, at Athlete's World in the mall, which it was fine, but, you know, I'm not good at selling things. I'm like, really? Do you want to spend that much money? And it was commission-based, so I was making minimum wage. I was like, yeah, I definitely want to work in this lab. Like, I'm totally in. So I continued working in his lab, studying motor control and learning, but I became really interested through my degree in ergonomics. I debated going into engineering for my undergrad, and it seemed like this really cool way to kind of blend, hey, we know stuff about the human, but how do we design systems around it? So for my master's, I ended up going to University of Toronto and going into the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering, where I did a lot of human factors work. That's where I started some defense research. I worked with DRDC. But then for my PhD, and that work was really on combat decision making. And I found it really interesting that you had to make these really high risk decisions really, really quickly. And the consequence of a mistake was really large. So I wanted to study how we make these sort of rapid decisions. And I thought back to, you know, the motor control and learning stuff I did. And anytime we plan an action, it's really kind of this rapid selection process that we have to execute. So went back, did a kinesiology degree using kind of motor control concept to study decision making, and then decided to, you know, you finish your PhD, I'll tell you this, you finish your PhD and you kind of feel like, wow, I'm pretty smart. I know something. I managed to write a thesis. I know a lot about this area. But then for my postdoc, I'm like, oh, I'll do something completely different that I don't really know what I'm doing. So I went into, did a postdoc at University of Oxford in clinical neuroscience, which was incredibly intimidating. I had to learn about MRI. I think on my first week, I asked another, like, a PhD student, because I had to locate the hand knob in the brain. I'm like, where's the hand knob? And I realize now that that was not a very smart question. And they're probably like, oh my goodness, who is
they're
this?
They're like, what are we dealing with?
Oh dear. So, and then after that, I came to Dalhousie and started the lab, which is, now you can see why you kind of get all the different areas.
Yeah. I just kept kind of going into all the different areas. Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, maybe I can do them all at once.
And here you are, you're doing them all at once.
I think it's fun that you started your post-secondary at Dal and now you're back at Dal.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's still really, like, the first year was weird. Like, I go into a classroom and I'm like, oh, this is where I had first year calculus. And And so that was, it's getting less and less weird, but there's still sometimes, like, I teach in a new room and it's just like this flood of memories just come right back. So
I think the work that you did aligns a lot with stuff that I encountered in my undergrad. I actually, one of my good friends studies decision making, not in combat, but in firefighting.
Oh, cool.
So they use mobile EEG to look at kind of how, like, they use it as a measure of I don't know exactly which ERP components they measure, but I think they use it to see like whether or not their decision making is impacted, or whether they're making, it's like the amplitude of the waveforms, I guess, is what they're looking at. But anyways, he did his 3-minute thesis on this topic, and it was like him standing in front of like the most giant fire you've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Because it's not just firefighting, but it's wildfire firefighting. And just about the importance of making sure that wildfire firefighters are rest, like they take rest before making these like big decisions. But like the reality of that job is more like you're working nonstop.
You don't really get to choose when you rest.
Yeah,
you
know? So I think it's, I don't know if like the outcome of his research is more bringing light to this issue, that there are big decisions to make in this job and a lot of fatigue that goes into it. But it is the tie between fatigue and decision making. So
yeah, that's and that it just seems like such a challenging decision context, because you have kind of these moment to moment decisions, but then you're trying to anticipate into the future and make decisions on things that are just wildly unknown. So and with fatigue, that would be really difficult.
And it's There's another thing. Oh, yes. It's not just fatigue that affects them, too. I mean, lots of things affect them, but it's also the temperature of the environment, which can also affect decision-making. So it's definitely a hot topic.
Not to be literal.
I was, like, going to be, like, quite literally.
Quite literally a hot topic. But, yeah, I'm sure you guys would find very – like interesting similarities.
Are they here at Dell?
That's at UVic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But if you ever want to look into their research,
go travel.
Do like a memory lane when you did your combat and decision making research.
Well, that also relates a bit to some of the work we do in like command and control. So if you think you have like a command and control boat on a Navy ship and you're trying to manage, you know, you might have submarines, you might have the ship, you have aircraft, and how are you managing all those things and anticipating what might happen in the future? So I think there is like a lot of crossover. So there can be these like really rapid, you know, kind of battle space moment to moment decisions, but then also these evolving situations where you're trying to manage where to put resources and stuff. And there's a real interest in providing automated support for that. So that's a really, you know, big topic right now.
So the next question that we have kind of has a bit of a preface. So a lot of times researchers are quick to chat about their successes of their research, but they're not as quick to talk about the instances where things went wrong in research. And so we were wondering if you can tell us about a time that things didn't go as planned in your research journey. So it can be anything about, you know, decisions you made about where you're going in research or the actual research itself.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we should probably have a whole podcast on
this. I know.
have a whole list. I'm going to give an answer that's not specifically about the research, but about communicating research. So it was during my PhD, and there was two different it's about presentation skills essentially. I was first of all asked to guest lecture in a class, and then I was supposed to give an hour long departmental seminar, and it was in a kin department. So it has like people with like pretty diverse range of interests, from more of sort of like social science to exercise physiology, and I'm doing this kind of motor decision making. And same thing when I was teaching the class, it's like the second year undergrads. And I felt like I had to fill the presentation with so much information to appear smart. Like, look at all this stuff. If I have to tell you everything I know, so you know that I know it and I know what I'm talking about. And guess what? That has the complete opposite effect. Both just absolutely tanked. Like, students complained about me in the course.
No.
And then after I gave the seminar, I was like hanging out with like my lab mates, and we're all pretty close. I was like, okay, so like, what did you guys think? They're like, Heather, like, oh, that was like, they're trying to be, oh, that was good. But like, we barely understood it, and we're in your lab, and I
we work with you.
And I was just like, so people didn't think I was smart. And that was, I maybe I'm choosing it because there is like a lesson or a redemption. Mm-hmm. Is now when I try to do presentations, you're thinking, okay, I actually just need to get my message across. I need to make it easy for the listener because they have a huge task, right? Like it's a huge working memory task to sit through a presentation. Well, yeah. I'm trying to remember what the purpose was. What does that line on the graph mean? What does this mean in my life? Wow, I'm really, really hungry right now. I wonder if it'll be pizza at the break. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, and that was just such a huge lesson. And I bombed multiple times before it, like, mm-hmm. actually sunk in. So yeah. One that's kind of, I think it's because I'm better at it now that I, every time I give a presentation, it just, I'm like, oh, remember that time?
Yeah.
Really, really bad.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that a lot of researchers can relate to that story. And Teresa and I, we were just recently at this conference and we went to a pretty good workshop on storytelling, and she definitely highlighted some of the
yes.
less desirable traits of a scientist and their ways of presenting and stuff. And I think there's a lot to learn about, like, simplification. And all of my favorite presentations have been, like, 95% pictures and 10%
yes.
5% words. And
what I remember from it is the take-home message, like you said. Yeah. I'm not remembering all these little facts or these other studies. I just want to know, like, why I would maybe go home and then look at another study or something, right?
Exactly that. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, when you have that take-home message, when you need to put in bits of complexity, because there's times we can't
simplify.
But you can say, here's my take-home message, but here, if you're looking at this, you're going to take this complex thing and eventually get home to that take-home message. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, providing those kind of guideposts so you can explore some of the complexity, but then come back up and be like, all right, everybody, let's have a mental break and remember what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, too, it really depends on the situation. Like, I think in kind of like a guest talk or you're at a conference and you're giving a presentation, like take home message and images and storytelling.
Why it excites you.
Yeah, very effective. But if you're in like a 4 month long course, like as a student, I do want text. Like I don't want to have to type everything that you're saying down. So it really depends on the context. But I do think that as scientists, we have a tendency to like big words.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we already heard a bit about what type of research you do in your lab. So I'll ask you, what current research project are you most excited about?
Oh my goodness. That's like choosing a favorite child. this is not a fair question.
Although, to be fair, it's just about what you're most excited about, not your favorite.
Not your favorite, just what...
Like what the results that you're most looking forward to seeing. Yeah. I don't know. It does sound like
Yeah, it does sound like you're picking a favorite.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Is geez a swear word? No, it's not.
You could have easily said cheese.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I'm just kidding.
Oh, camembert.
Oh, golly.
This is me just delaying while I try to
figure out how to.
Well, you know what? I'm going to give you one that's going to come up soon, and then I'm going to give you like a future research project.
Okay.
So we are doing this work on exercise and cognition, and specifically how exercise can mitigate stress. And first of all, it's a really big project to do. It like, we just started data collection like in February 2020, and then it obviously had to shut down. And now I have a really great student, Corey, leading it. And I think I'm really interested in it because at least in terms of a personal connection, I use exercise a lot to deal with stress. And so I'm excited to see how those results turn out. We're doing the FNIRs with it. So we're doing some neuroimaging to try to understand how exercise actually might help the brain deal with stress. And mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a nice project too, because it's one of those ones I can go home to my parents and they
will understand
and they'll be like, you know, my dad really likes to exercise as well, so mm-hmm. be like, oh, that's That's good work.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of looking to the future. So Juliet, I know you've met him. I have a visiting postdoc from Switzerland, Stefan Zano here, and he does really cool work in thinking about how you can take sports context, but then ask theoretical questions with them about motor control. So it's all my theoretical motor control stuff. And then his research is like, okay, but let's put that on the tennis court. Let's put it in a more kind of real world situation, but you still have all this experimental control. And I'm like, it's just, it's renewed my excitement for that area a lot, because I think it's taking stuff that, and I love experimental psychology. Like it's really fun, the theory for me, and I can go down a theoretical rabbit hole forever in it, but it's really fun to then say, okay, take it out and put it, does it actually work
in the real environment,
or at least more ecological environments. So that's kind of been like a new inspiration in a way for going forward. So, but I'm excited about all my projects. Like whenever there's like, oh, we have a new data set, I'm like, oh, this is the best day. So
No, sorry for the difficult question. To be honest, anytime I'm asked about favorites, I list like my top five.
And it, you know what, it really changes day to day, and that's one thing I've appreciated about having kind of the three main research streams in my lab, because I won't lie, I get burnt out of them sometimes. You're dealing with reviews on a paper and you're just like, oh, there's so much nuance to this. Doesn't even matter. Is this research going to have an impact?
Yeah.
But then you can kind of like think about the one that's exciting you a little bit. So that's the one thing I at least helps me having the multiple research areas is you can have one kind of chug along and be excited about one, but it honestly switches like day to day, week to week.
No, I do think that like looking to collaborate with others and finding excitement through that is like a huge thing that we need to like look to doing more, because I gave Stefan a tour of the lab just yesterday, and it is just so refreshing to have someone be so interested in everything that you say.
Yeah, I came in later because I knew he was in there at 9:30, and I was shocked he was still there. I was like, is he held trapped? Like, is he okay? But he was talking to me, and he didn't even want to leave. I was like, okay, good.
So I'm really glad you came in, because your work with errors and stuff.
Yes, we were talking about it. Yes. Very interesting.
Yeah, because originally I was telling him about like some of the error-based research we have done in the past, and I was like, oh, I really wish Teresa was here to give you an explanation of her research, because it's the only one that I haven't like fully grasped yet, because I was just a participant in it, and then thankfully she came
before
he left.
because
his research really peaked when I started talking about the DART study. And it does remind me a little bit about, so when we first came up with the idea to like ask your parents to tell us what we're doing for research, my brother called me and he was like, I just listened to the podcast and I laughed so hard because I knew our parents weren't going to do it. And then he's like, but then I got to thinking, like, I don't even know what you're doing for research. And he's doing, he's going to be starting his PhD soon. So he's in the academic world, like he's interested in what I'm doing. So I gave him an overview. And so for listeners out there, there's basically just understanding how we adapt to new environments, but specifically in a context where you don't get feedback. So it's like, can you adapt to, I'll give an extreme example, like if you start on gravity on Earth and then you go to a place with zero gravity, can we adapt to zero gravity conditions without actually like physically moving in them? And he was like, oh, Juliet, you know, like we're studying the same thing. And so I was like, no way, because he's doing computer science and he's doing self-driving cars. How could we possibly be studying the same thing, you know? But his research question is trying to figure out how he can get an automated car to adapt to in a new environment without having any prior experience. It's like not the same question, but it's very,
it's
very
so
similar.
It's a lot of the same. similar.
So it's like really funny how we ended up in like basically the same research field, or but like question, but very
different
fields. I'm really curious. I'm like, tell me what you find. You know, like if you can do it, because I guess like dream performance for his question would be like you could just drop a car anywhere in the world and within seconds
it will learn,
be able to drive around that place. But might be more of a dream than a reality.
Well, as your local human automation interaction researcher, you're like, well, but it's, you know, that's actually a really interesting example, because when I first started out in this field, like, you know, we talk about self-driving cars as kind of like a ha 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 in the future. Yeah. And then even since I started teaching at Dalhousie, like it's an example we use a lot in class, because the way Halifax is, a lot of people drive, people have been in cars, they can imagine driving. So it comes up a lot of an example. And even just in like the 7-8 years I've been teaching like the cognitive ergonomics, which is the human factors course, it's gone from like, oh yeah, in the future, to people are like, yeah, I was in a Tesla yesterday, and that's why it's a really exciting field to be in too, because it's very much needed. This is, of course, I'm saying, oh, my research is needed, human automation interaction, but I think it's becoming more and more relevant, and people are seeing it impact their day-to-day life.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that your research does have an impact. And we were just having these discussions in our conference that we attended, just like understanding that basic science, like while the impact might not be so clear when you're doing the research, it's like down the line, it starts to become very apparent that like what you're doing is really, really
impactful.
Instead
of waiting like 2 years after publication, you have to wait like 20.
Yeah, 20 years, stuff
and,
like that.
And
yeah.
I think too, it's like the importance of discovery is we have to do a lot of different things that may not have an immediate impact, because by the nature of doing science, we're trying to figure out unknowns. So if we knew something would have impact, well, we just go,
do it.
Although it would be way simpler.
Although I find that about theoretical, so I do theoretical-ish exercise research now, but like we know it's good. Like just go, like, maybe we should pour more money into like helping people figure out how to do it.
And like addressing the barriers and stuff. I think that's like the one sort of rabbit hole researchers can go down. It's like, I know all this information, but I don't see it used in the real world. But yeah, it's something we're still working on. And the conclusion of our conference was basically it's difficult.
Yes, that was the resounding basic idea was it is difficult.
It is very difficult, but we are working our best. It was difficult. That was one of the outcomes, and that it's not a linear process.
Yes.
So I'm sure like as you've gone through your research journey, things have peaked in impact and like not in a very linear way.
Yeah. So. And it's funny what sort of gets picked up and when it gets picked up. So we all have a paper put out and it will sit somewhere for years, and then all of a sudden somebody calls you up and they're like, oh, I really want to know more about this, or I want to do that. And then you have a paper I did a theoretical paper called I wrote it with some colleagues, and it's called No One Knows What Attention Is. And now it's like the most cited paper. And it came up, we were at a conference and we're at a brewery that was a windmill drinking beer, complaining about attention. And then somebody's like, we should write a paper. And then now it's like the most cited paper I had that came from like drinking beers at a windmill in Amsterdam. So like it's very, very, very non-linear in that way.
Yeah. Arguably some of the best research happens at, you know, drinks after work hours.
Yes.
So our next question for you is, as a PI, what advice would you want to give to students looking to pursue research?
This is actually a really good segue, because I'm going to take the picture of, you know, maybe you're an undergrad, you know, volunteering in the lab, doing your honors. You're like, should I do a master's? You're doing your master's. You're like, here there's no academic positions. Like, should I pursue a PhD? And like, what is research? And I would say take a lot of different opportunities during your research experience, even if they don't relate to your research. So oftentimes we think, oh, I got to get my thesis done. So, you know, I have to go to this departmental seminar and they're going to be talking about, you know, social psychology and sport, and that's not related to what I do. And, oh, this is so annoying. Yeah. But you never know when you're going to need that in the future, or you're going to need certain skills in the future and when they'll pop up or have creativity. So I think it's making that space that a lot of times you're going to have to do things that you don't see directly relate, but then you'll be surprised, like, oh, that's actually going to help my research move forward. Or, hey, somebody asked me to collaborate and that's not really my area, but I went to the seminar so I can at least kind of speak in similar terms and approach to them. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you're continuing on and doing a master's and PhD, it's creating this network. So there's other opportunities that are not just faculty positions coming out and kind of seeing these different opportunities. So mm-hmm. I would say use your experience in kind of that research environment where there's a lot of kind of creative information being put out and kind of do a few things that are outside of your immediate interest area. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this, you two are nodding along. So you're like, yeah, I'm recording a podcast. Like we are, I don't know who professional podcast recorders are, but like, you're like, oh, I'm not a radio DJ or whatever. So this sort of experience, right?
I think Juliet and I both share and have talked about how we just love learning. Yes. And even the conference we just went to, it was more social science-y. I mean, they were literally all experts in how to measure impact. And then we came here being like, we're just studying motor imagery. Yay.
Yeah. Basically.
But we loved being there and learning and taking notes and everything just because as students going into research, we're naturally curious, you would think, right?
Yeah. The thing is, like I talked about this with Teresa a little bit, is like one thing that I struggled with as a student is actually finding something that excites me more than something else, because it's just like every time I go to a talk, I'm like, wow, this is so interesting. Yeah. Like, you know, even when I was at Stefan's talk, I was like, maybe I should go to Switzerland.
Like, you're like, maybe I'll come back with you.
Yeah.
I think we all might go to Switzerland after that talk now. So
I wish I could have been there.
Yeah. Honestly, it's just like, anyways, it looks like they're doing such fun research over there. And plus, I've never been to Switzerland.
I haven't been either. And I think I now have a very good excuse to go. So I'm excited.
Yeah.
But in those sorts of scenarios, like, you know, like the conference you went to on impact, I just said you should do it, but then it's also intimidating because you realize there's this whole other expertise out there that maybe 5% of, and you're like, I can never know all of this, which is maybe why you go to conferences for people that know it really well. But
well, I think actually, like, one of the experiences of being a student, and I'm not saying that I'm an expert, but I think one of the kind of universe, like what makes all experts similar is their agreement that the more you know, the less you know. It's like the farther you get into the field, the more you're open up to just like anything being possible, basically. So it is intimidating, but you go to these conferences and you realize, oh, you guys study this extensively, but you still, you know, you know more than me, but you're open to the fact that you don't know everything.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it is really cool. And also, I thought of a really cheesy metaphor, question mark. Is that the right word? in your advice that you give students, but it's like, students are like neurons. You gotta form connections.
That could be like a little t-shirt and some like little neurons
just
holding
little neurons and connecting.
Yeah.
You got to strengthen those connections.
Yeah, guys, like, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together. Yeah.
But then isn't there like a process where you start to lose
connections? Yeah, I was also thinking about that. Yeah.
But I like it. I like the idea of some cute neurons.
And yeah.
Yeah, with happy faces.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll try to get the merch out.
We'll workshop that.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, Heather, and we can still talk about it, how you came up with the name for your lab.
Oh.
But I also thought it would be fun to do the first date questions.
Okay,
just because they're a fun thing to
end
on.
We can end on those as well, but we can start with this.
So how did you come up with the name for your lab, and were you purposely going for an acronym?
Okay, so the thing about the name for the lab was we had an admin at our school, and he comes down and he's like, all right, your lab's getting set up. I'm going to make a sign for your lab. I need the name of your lab by tomorrow. And I don't know why it was by tomorrow. Like, a sign doesn't cost that much. That'd be like, but it was like, yeah, you have to come up with it or there'll be no sign on your lab. I don't think he actually meant that, but that was kind of that. So I'm like, oh no, like, what? So I like sat down and I just started like writing down every single word that might apply to the lab. And then I did kind of want an acronym because I don't know, it's kind of catchy.
It's fun.
It's whatever. And I couldn't come up with a lot. And then all of a sudden I spelled the word camp and I'm like, okay, like I've been at this for an hour. I have a million things to do. This is like, you know, I do cognitive and motor performance. Yeah. Like it's pretty descriptive. So at least the full name is descriptive. And then it was Camp Lab, but we don't actually like. We actually just joked we all love camping, so we might do a lab camping trip this summer.
Oh, that'd be fun. Nice. Count me in.
Yeah. Both labs invited too. Yeah. So, but then the one benefit is that like we can call our lab members campers, which I kind of.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. That is cute.
Yeah. But we do nothing with camping, so like. Yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah. Although, and it's funny too. We're in the basement of the Dalplex, but we. Chris Holland, who's in the lab, just gave a talk, and then he put up pictures of all of us at the end, and we're all outdoors for some reason. I all kind of look very like I'm holding a block of ice in Iceland. Somebody's by a lake, and I'm like, we look very nature-y for being in the Dalplex
a whole lot.
So
yeah,
So anyway, lab camping trip. You know, it'd be fun if we got multiple like.
We can do group camping at Kedgy.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And each lab can kind of have a base camp.
Yes. And then oh, sorry. And then come together.
Excited. And like host each, like what, like each lab takes a night to cook and then has a recreational activity and some like competitive games.
Ooh, and then we can do our family feud.
Yes, we at this conference they did family feud and we were very excited.
Oh, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
No, I think we should.
I think we should.
We should plan this. Yeah. And we'll, maybe a third lab.
Yeah.
That'll be a hard choice.
Yeah. Third lab.
If anyone's listening, reach out.
Yeah. if you want to come on the neuroscience. Actually, you don't have to be neuroscience. Yeah,
no, you know, it could be cool. Maybe if you're in Switzerland, let us know where we can camp. So not to cut off that great camping conversation, but I have the utmost important question to ask you right now. How many seagulls would you find in your house before you start thinking someone is putting them there?
Oh, one.
That you would think someone else put it there?
Well, like, is it a live seagull?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, how else would it get? Like,
maybe someone left the door open.
Oh, yeah. Like, that, I mean.
That's a good point.
That my husband would leave the door open, but. But our dog would chase it out, so you'd have to, like, somehow constrain the dog.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to say one. I just feel like I know people that would be seagull placers.
It's like immediately. It's like, I already know who did this.
It's like, I'm calling them.
Yeah. Please, no more seagulls. I know what you're up to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good answer. To be honest, I would like to think mine is also one.
Really?
Although, interestingly, during the beginning of COVID, I had like three peacocks visit my front deck.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, hey.
That was in Victoria. Because they have a bunch of peacocks.
So they usually live in like Beacon Hill Park. But I guess once all the humans left the streets,
they were like peacock party.
And they just like, let's explore.
Yeah, they were just like literally on my front porch and my cat's like on the stairs, like staring them down. Like, what is this big blue bird? Like, yeah. Anyways, it was quite cool. I mean, yeah, the pandemic, not cool, but the peacocks, very
seeing,
cool.
Seeing peacocks making the best of a really terrible situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like it would take me two seagulls or two separate times. It'd have to happen more than once, I think. I think I would be very gullible and think, no one put this here. It just flew in and I'd deal with it, you know?
You know, that's actually fair.
Yeah. Although I'm not sure how it would fly into my apartment building. So that would be a little more weird, but I do think I still wouldn't think someone put it there.
Yeah. So I also have to preface, my husband brings random stuff home all the time. And so like I constantly walk into my house. I'm like, why is this here? Like, at one point, candle holders showed up and we're like, I'm like, these aren't mine. Like, you brought these in. He totally forgot he brought them in too until his friend came over. She's like, oh, those are the candle holders I gave you.
Oh,
like,
I just
always have to accept that
there's going to be random things. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Seagulls are big, though. If it was like a smaller thing, I think the number could go up. Like, if it was, like, this is a weird one, but the, like, burnt out light bulbs, I think it could get in the hundreds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just think it was a little bit more subtle.
Yeah.
Although we also had a phase of starlings fainting on our chimney because they get high from the furnace gases and fall down our chimney. And so we eventually, we did put a grate over it because it's not fun to have starlings.
Yeah.
And it stresses them out, too, so... I'm not, like, I've had birds in my house before, but there was more of an explanation that I wasn't suspicious.
Yeah.
So our last question for you is, you're in an arena with any animal. You have to fight it to its death. No matter which animal, it's human-sized. What animal do you pick and why? That's actually, as I was reading that, I'm like, that's sad.
I don't want to kill any animals.
Yeah. How can we rephrase this question? You have to beat it at a. You just have to win.
I just have to win.
You just have to win in any way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to pin it.
Okay. Yes. There we go. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I don't know. So it's human size. So I could take something that's human, like a sloth.
Yeah. Oh, a sloth is a good one.
Yeah. So I think by not killing it, it makes it easier because I'm like, I could never kill a sloth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could just lay on it and be happy.
Yeah. And we just cuddle.
Yeah. And you'd be like, I pinned it.
I'm thinking, like, the only thing human size that I would gladly kill is, like, no, not human size. The only, like, I don't think it's an animal, though. It's like a mosquito. But, like, a human-sized mosquito.
I can't even kill bugs. And it's really, like, well, it's also because I'm, like, really phobic. So I, first of all, like, the crunch. Okay. And then I feel bad, but I'm phobic, so I run away. It's,
It's just a whole thing. Yeah. No, I will save any spider that comes into my house, but... mosquitoes, I'm ruthless. Like, they're massive mosquitoes.
Actually, I have smacked mosquitoes. I actually think of it, they're on my body. I smack them off. Because then it's like, that's kind of like the battle. Like, like, you're biting me. But I guess, like, it's just a bite and I'm killing them, but still, they're...
I don't even know what animal I would choose. Because if I chose, like, a human-sized cat, like, at that point, it's probably just, like... you know, a scary lion. Cat. Yeah.
what about just another human? Because then it would just be like a wrestling match.
Then it's just a wrestling match.
Yeah.
And I would like play rugby. I think I would have some sort of advantage versus like another animal. We used to always have this debate too among rugby players. Like if you had a half human, half lizard to play rugby against, would you want the top half to be human and bottom be lizard, but there'd be a big tail? Or would you want the top to be lizard and the bottom to be human? So... I mean, maybe that can be a question for guests. You might have to take it outside of the rugby
podcast. Yeah, they might be like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, what's your sport of choice? Now, if you had to play against an opposition.
That is a good question.
That was half human, half lizard. What would you...
I think I would choose top half human. I'm kind of scared of, like, being bit by a lizard, I guess.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'd do the opposite, I feel like. Hmm. Especially if the lizard had, like, smaller hands. At least it couldn't get near me. And it doesn't have its tail to swipe.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
I think that's what I'd lean to as well. But then it's like, but then if you had that player on your team, who would you want it?
Probably be switched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you'd want.
I'd want them.
Especially for rugby.
Yeah.
But if it was soccer, then, you know, it's like.
Yeah, then you want, like, the little lizard arms. So there wouldn't be handballs.
Right? Yeah.
It really depends on the context. Yeah. All right. Well, that sums it up for our first date questions.
Well, those were first date questions.
Yeah, those are first date questions.
Those are, I mean, those, you guys must go on some fun dates.
Yes.
These are courtesy of Hudson.
Yeah, they're meant to be. Oh, but it's not Hudson from Vancouver.
Just yes, it's not Hudson from Vancouver. Hudson.
But anyways, they're just meant to provoke interesting conversation.
Oh, okay,
it's not
rather than like, what's your favorite color?
Yeah.
How many brothers or sisters do you have?
Yeah, like things like that. We wanted something a bit more. Fun.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyways, it was so fun having you on today's podcast and learning about all the three different research areas and knowing which student is your favorite.
Can't wait to send them this episode of the podcast. I'm not joking.
They're all my favorite.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank
and
you
chatting
for having me.
Us.
This was a lot of fun. Yes. So.
Up next, we have recommendations with Cassidy Klein.
Hello, hello. It's me, Cass, back again to Get Wrecked. I have a variety of television shows, podcasts, and fun activities that I've been loving recently that I'd like to share with you. So first off, I have a television show on Netflix called The Night Agent. So this was a recommendation to me from my brother, and it is about an FBI agent who works to determine who the mole in the White House is. It's a great show. It's action-packed. It has crazy cliffhangers. I really, really enjoyed this show. I don't have much else to say. It was a quick watch for me. Super exciting. 10 out of 10 recommend. The next show that I would like to recommend is Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso is on Apple TV. This is one of my personal favorite sitcoms. It's essentially about an American football coach who's hired by a British football or soccer team and about his endeavors and embarking on this new crazy adventure. It's witty, it's relatable, and it's inspiring, and the casting is wicked. Jason Sudeikis plays the lead, and he's hilarious and super funny. Season 3 is out now, and I'm so excited to watch. And my last recommendation is another Netflix show. It's called The Dark Tourist. So this is a bit of a different show than what I typically watch, and it's an older but a goodie. David Ferrier is a journalist who travels to places that are less likely to be traveled due to their typical association with more dark and tragic events. So if you like history and you like travel, I would definitely recommend this show. Again, it kind of allows you to explore these different areas and places that you may not think to travel to or learn about. It's a great show, and I totally recommend.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.